This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Product Coffee, a podcast where product management leaders share stories, advice, and thoughts on all things product over a cup of coffee. Grab a cup of Joe and join us to level up your product career 30 minutes at a time.
Let's get things started. On the show today, we have the amazing, the spectacular Marty Kagan. I don't know how else to introduce you other than this. I feel like a lot of listeners on the show have already know who you are familiar with the books, and are probably in progress or have not, if not completed, transformed as the new book has just come out. Thank you for coming on the show again.
Thanks for inviting me, Kevin.
We have a bunch of questions from our listeners, and then I have some questions as well. I just finished the book Transformed. I had just mentioned to you before we hit record, but I think it answers a lot of those kind of hanging questions as a leader in these organizations that were kind of on my mind personally, and I know with a lot of others. What has been the general feedback that you've seen from the market so far?
It's only been out about a week, really. We're getting it two weeks. It's still very early, but so far, it's been really great to hear the feedback. And the main things people tell me is they like the case studies a lot because it's easy to talk about this stuff. It's a lot harder to point to really good examples where they did what they needed to do to succeed. Those examples are not as frequent. And so to be able to find a book full of them, people seem to really appreciate that. The other thing I keep hearing about is, you probably remember, but the last big chunk of the book is all these objections that we've heard forever. And all you have to do is go on LinkedIn and you can hear 100 objections. These are from people that have either never done it or never succeeded in it. And so there are objections. And for the most part, they're totally legit objections. They're like, look, they don't know the answer to this. Now, some people, because they don't know the answer, assume there is no answer. But other ones have a more open mind and say, maybe somebody's actually got an answer for that. So we wanted to put those objections. As you saw, it's a long list of objections from all kinds of different stakeholders, because we've been gathering this list for 20 years. So it's a big list. And a lot of people have told me now they finally have the words to describe and to be able to have a decent answer for their CEO or for their head of sales or for their stakeholders. And so I think those are the two things that I'm really glad we did in the book. Both of those are hard things to do because they're not as easy as just writing about a principle, for example.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think that just the pull quotes, like time to money over, was it time to delivery? Is that right?
Or
I can't remember that one.
Time to money.
Thank you. Time to market versus time to money. That alone, oh my goodness, has been like, yes, like I can use that when I'm talking. Like that's exactly the right type of phrase for that statement. So I love that. And then you've said this a lot, but the empowered for problems to solve versus features to ship. I think those two really encapsulate, I feel like, all the methodologies that you pulled together and then shared broadly to illustrate what these good product companies do. So I think that alone has been really good tools for myself personally, but I think the rest of the industry. Going back 20 years, you've been in product for way longer than that, but the SVPG, right? Was that 20 years for them?
Okay. And even when we started SVPG, the reason we started is because people were going to companies, people we worked with, that were not working the way the companies, good companies do. And they were looking for help on how to transform. We didn't really call it transformation back then. We just called it education. But then, of course, outside of, you start going outside of Silicon Valley and you find these big old pre-internet companies, and it really is a true transformation there.
Yeah, I feel like areas of the U.S. are more, it can't be specific to companies, but are more advanced within this way of working versus others. I know the U.K., for example, is a little bit behind in terms of the titles or like the functions and how they operate a little bit. But there's glimmers of the hope. There's really good companies like Spotify and others that are out there. And
yeah, I think it's the truth is, even in San Francisco, there are terrible companies right across the street from good companies. This continues to boggle my mind. It's so unjustified to me. It's just a waste of money. But that's the reality. And in London, there's awesome teams. I wrote about one of my favorites in the book, Trainline, or right across the street from teams that are like 20 years behind. In Stockholm, you have Spotify, which is terrific, right across the street from companies that are 20 years behind. So it's really not about the place in the world. That was a stronger argument 20 years ago, just because the techniques had not spread. But today, I work with teams in every corner of the world. I just got off a call with a bunch of product people in Pakistan. And in the book, we wrote about product work going on in Saudi Arabia. My partner, Christian, and I and my partners have been helping teams in Nigeria. They're all over today.
How do you see that discipline evolving in different parts? It sounds like there's good product people everywhere, right? But are there specific aspects of those cultures that you find like particularly interesting or effective?
Yeah, there is the whole cultural element. So we can talk about that. We should. That's a really good topic. But the truth is, my view, and I'm very biased. Look, I wrote a book called Empowered, right? Which is all about if you just take good people and you give them the tools they need and the teaching, coaching they need, they do amazing things. So that's exactly what I believe. Okay, and that's what I see all over the world. The problem is not with the talent of the people. It's just not. Now, most of them have never seen good. They have no idea. So once you show them what good looks like, most of them are absolutely capable of doing this. So that's not really, I think, what's going on. It's more about educating and winning the hearts and minds of the leaders so that they don't, frankly, give up before they even try. A lot of people, they just don't want to try. And that sort of leads to the cultural differences. And there are different cultures out there, obviously. Some people have authority means a different thing inside a company than others. So that's going on. But to me, that's the minor issue. The bigger issue is this topic of agency and whether or not people believe they can change themselves, their company, their team. And that's something that varies dramatically. I absolutely think it's an individual thing. So it turns out some individuals have very high sense of agency and some individuals just don't. On the other hand, I think it's not an accident. They are highly correlated to the cultures that they live in. For example, I've been sharing this just because it blew my mind. I've never seen such high agency as I found in teams in Nigeria. Just blew me away, the level of agency. Yeah. Same with teams in Israel, the level of agency, super high. In China, super high. So there are certain cultures where you just don't get in their way because they are going to do whatever they're going to do, for sure. They don't need a lot of permission. They don't need a lot of excuses. They will just go do it because they believe they need to do it. That's very high agency. It certainly makes it easier to transform when your people believe that they are absolutely have the right and the ability to do that.
And now they have the tools with materials that y'all have put together, and it seems very well accessible. How many languages is inspired in at this point?
A lot. And I just got an email from the publisher. Transformed is already underway in about 10 languages right now. And a lot of the content on Transformed and all our books is available for free on the website. And Google Translate does a pretty good job today on translating those. So we don't want firewalls. We don't want anything like that. We want anybody, if they're in Pakistan or Nigeria or if they're in Washington, D.C., we want them to be able to just access all the content in whatever language they want and hopefully show their company and their leaders what they can do.
I hear this a lot from a lot of leaders, or at least, and I think you might have addressed this in Transform, but correct me if I'm wrong. A lot of folks say, hey, Marty Kagan style of working, or it's really calling out SVPG as this is the thing that they develop, they're promoting, they're selling their service, so they're going to be specific about the things that work for their agency or their whatever they're trying to do. And I think you mentioned this in the book, but it's really not something that you all have defined. It's something that you've aggregated as knowledge to share with others on the best practices. Do you continually get that kind of those questions from folks?
First of all, you're right. In every single book, we say this. We say none of what we talk about here was invented by us, because it's true. Yeah. And there are some people that tend to think that we've invented things, or I think a lot of times they just use it as shorthand. They say sure. SVPG. Now with the new book, there's a name for it. It's called the product model. And we didn't even make up that name. We just adopted it. So now there's a name. But I think what's really going on is there have always been and there always will be people that look for reasons not to do something. And so they think I've heard this literally 1,000 times. This will only work in Silicon Valley. You know, and
this won't work for us.
This
right?
will work for us because we're in wherever, or because we do a device, or because we're enterprise, or because we have a senior leader that came from finance, or they just, whatever it is, they look for an excuse. And I do tell people, if you're looking for an excuse not to do this stuff, it's easy to find excuses. Super easy. There's no skill in that. The skill is in overcoming those, and that's back to that agency. And yeah, it's never been SVPG. It's only been, we try to be very open. What we do is we think we see this every day, the difference between how the best work and the rest, and we're all about sharing the techniques of the best because we don't see any reason why it should only be used by those companies. It could be used by anybody, and so that's what we encourage. Anybody who wants to should try them out. There's nothing really preventing them.
And when you work with companies today, you're working on coaching, you're working on setting up the right leadership or coaching leadership on these things as well. It seems like every engagement for you is a little bit different. Is that right?
Yeah, but the higher order point, to be honest, is because a lot of people probably don't know this. We're not a big thing. We're not like a McKinsey or whatever. We have 5 people. You can do the math in your head. How many companies could 5 people possibly work with? It's literally a handful every year.
And well, in that case, how do you pick and choose?
We pick the ones we like and the ones that are willing to pay for our services and like that. Sure. But the real point is there's no way we could work with as many people as want to work on this stuff. No way. So our model has long been, we do things like books. We do some online courses occasionally, stuff like that. It's virtual, in person, but it's only a lucky few, I think, that really do that. More often, what we do is we recommend to them a product coach. And we tell people, because it's true, we don't have any financial ties with any of the product coaches because we don't want that. We want, if we recommend a product coach to a company in anywhere in the world, we want them to know that there's only one reason we're recommending them. It's because we think they're good and can help you. We're not getting a kickback. We don't get a percentage, none of that. We have a set of people we've met around the world. In fact, you may know over the last couple of years, we ran a program to identify more good product coaches around the world. We've always had a handful of people that we love mostly in the Bay Area, but we put them at capacity years and years ago. People like Teresa Torres, people like Jeff Patton, they're still awesome. They're just very busy today. So we needed a list instead of 3, we needed a list of more like 100. And we don't have people to recommend everywhere in the world. There are some gaps that we're still trying to meet. There are product coaches everywhere in the world. I bet there are good ones everywhere in the world. We just don't know them.
Yeah. What is your process to qualify or to,
It's difficult. It's mostly getting to know them. And then it's also getting to talk to the people who they've worked with and see what they've done there. But the other thing that's, we're very public on what to look for in a good coach. We tell the coaches what they need to do, but we also tell companies, like, if you're looking for a coach, make sure you know what you're looking for. And so we tell them, look for real product experience. We tell them what we look at when we're evaluating a coach. And if they've never been there, done that at a real product company, how are they possibly going to help you? And this is the problem today. And for example, a lot of agile coaches have never worked at a product company. So there's not much they can really help with.
On this topic, when you are working with companies or these coaches, I would imagine, deal with some very similar topics, but they're in the process of either coaching or transforming their product culture. And within that, I want to hear from you and your experience over the last 20 years. What have been the areas that you've tried to implement that transformation where it failed or where you learned something that evolved the way that you're approaching this change management within organizations?
Yeah, we've been watching these changes go on for years. And first of all, there's assessing them. So we have evolved our assessment a lot over the years because you start to learn that there's other things you need to assess than you realized. It's not just product managers, for example. You have to assess the whole organization really as far as how they conceive of, build, and deploy their products. So our assessment has grown as one example. We've also realized that, so there's basically where the company's starting from and where they want to get to. We have a good idea of where we think they need to get to, but we first have to learn where they're starting from. And so every company has a different set of things that they need to do. And then they have a different set of challenges getting in the way of doing those things. So maybe they're in a part of the world that doesn't have good access to design talent or whatever it might be. And so we all have to tailor these plans. And you may have noticed in the book, there was a long section on transformation techniques because we've learned in different situations, you need different approaches. And it's very similar to product discovery where there's no one way to do it, no one recipe because the situation is different. The risks are different. The problem is different. The customers are different. So you need to teach people the techniques and the judgment to use the right combination. So we've seen lots of failed transformations. In fact, most of the time we go to help a company, they have already tried and failed at least once. So we write about these anti-patterns. And in fact, if you're interested, just Google the term SVPG transformation fail. We wrote the major reasons we see transformations fail. And so every time you learn about these patterns, you start building into your going forward work, ways to prevent that, to address it.
You're always iterating, you're getting better at these things, and absolutely you're accounting for those gaps that you didn't really see initially or you experienced through repetitions. Now that you have published the book, if you were to add another chapter to it, what would it be?
Not the truth, Kevin, is the truth is it's too soon to know, because literally answering that question now would be no. We do have, I was mentioning the objections before. We knew that we would continue to encounter other objections. And that's the problem with a physical book, right? Like a device, once you've shipped it, it's done. It's gone. So we created an article on our website, which is a living article. It's called Transformed FAQ. And starting literally a couple days after the book went out, we started adding questions and answers to that. So if you've been online and you've seen objections or questions, confusions, you can look in that document and hopefully you'll see all of the significant ones. A lot of them are basically just people whining that, oh, this is hard. But though there's also legitimate objections out there on social media. And those are the ones where we've added them. And I continue every couple of days, I'll add another question and answer that I see. Because I'll see online, I will tell you, I'm not really a fan of social media. To me, it's incredibly poorly designed product. Look, I answer a question on Monday, and by Tuesday, there are three other threads that have no idea that question's already been asked and answered. It's so useless as far as accumulated learning. So I don't play that game. I don't try to whack-a-mole every time somebody says, what about X? So what I do is we add it to the article, and if people are interested, we point them to that article. Yeah. You'll see those.
That's something that I wanted to make sure folks found as well. That brings up an interesting question about ethics, and you've spoken a lot about this in the past, about that potentially being another factor when you're considering product teams, the risks that they should validate, especially with social media being one of these things that is poorly designed, but also is having psychological effects to many folks, younger kids that are getting into these things. And then we have AI, right? There's so many ethics questions going on at the moment. And I wonder, where's your head at with all of this? Are you seeing teams actually work to de-risk these? And do they have the tools at the moment to de-risk the ethical risks?
Well, ethical risk has always been part of viability risk. The only real question was, should we break it out into a fifth risk? Just because it is so important. And I would agree with you. Generative AI puts an exclamation mark on that. Because, of course, it's all as good as the data going in, and there's a lot of issues in the data. We know all this. So we know there's real ethical risk. But I don't know the answer still. I'm torn because I do know with four, even the right number of product risks ideally would be three, because you can remember, everybody can remember three. Yeah. We upped it to four with Inspired version two because people were conflating two of the risks. So we upped it to four. I'm very reluctant to up it to anything over four because then I'm worried people won't remember it at all. Yeah. And then they, you know, if it's too confusing of a taxonomy or a not memorable taxonomy, then we're back to people not even thinking the different risks. And that would be a lot worse. But to your point, ethical risk is an important one, and generative AI is especially. I'm actually writing an article right now with one of the major AI leaders on this topic of, because it really, some of the roles generative AI is threatening. And I think that, by the way, includes things like a product owner. I would not want to be a product owner. Product manager, on the other hand, generative AI is shining a light on the importance of a real product manager. Because what is a product manager really there for? Value and viability. And those are two of the biggest challenges with AI-powered products. So it moves from a nice-to-have to a you-better-protect-your-company-here kind of risk.
Yeah.
Look what happened just a couple weeks ago to Google, and they know better, and they still got into big trouble because they were under a lot of pressure to push something out, and they pushed it without really understanding kind of what they were pushing live. And the good news is it's all still in kind of experimental state. But if they had done something like that 3 years from now, where these models are being used in production, I think it would have been a disaster for them.
Are there any specific advancements that get you excited about this versus more fearful, right?
It's the generative AI has huge potential and also huge risk. Yeah. I did write an article already. It was based on a keynote at an AI conference called The Future of Product Teams. And so if you want to know what I'm both really excited about and really nervous about, that would be the thing. Or you can watch an hour video or whatever of the talk. But this is, that's what I would suggest.
Do you find these leaders of these AI companies that have these broader implications, do they have those ethics in mind? Are they having the product mindset here, or is it just all hands on deck? Let's get things out fast.
And look, the truth is our industry does not have a good track record on this.
Yeah.
It just doesn't. To be honest, I think most of the time they're just not caring enough about it. Yeah. They just, Meta is a classic example of that, Facebook. And there's a lot of collateral damage that's created by the products. So we do not have a good track record. I don't blame anybody for not trusting a lot of the tech industry. Yeah. We need to do better as an industry, full stop. And generative AI is just the latest example. Before that was cryptocurrency, and we were not looking good on that one either.
What needs to be true for that to change?
Sort of beyond my pay grade, but there needs to be, I think there needs to be some consequences to the leaders. Yeah. There are very little real consequences to these things today. And anyway, so the economic model we have, especially in the U.S., takes a lot to slow them down. And you saw the turmoil. This was playing out at OpenAI on public a couple months ago. So the factors, even within that one company on this exact question, were very difficult. And you know how it worked out. I do believe that the vast majority of people in the industry do want to do good with the technology. They're not trying to be evil. that might not be true with cryptocurrency, but with generative AI, I do believe it's true that most people want to use it for good. But that doesn't mean that they're not under real pressure to get these things out before they've had a chance to examine the consequences. Sure.
Yeah, absolutely. And I feel like we're seeing that, the burst of innovation and all these product launches. My goodness, you can throw a shoe somewhere and hit an AI company at some point.
Yeah, we're seeing the same thing that happened with every other wave. The marketing people are calling everything AI right now, whether there is or isn't. This is, and I don't blame, that's just normal. Happened
taking
every
advantage of the
time.
Hype. Yeah.
So, like always, the buyers have to really ask themselves. Because the truth is, for most buyers, they don't care if AI is there or not. They just care if it solves their problem better than it did yesterday. If it doesn't, then it's just marketing and no benefit. If it does solve their problem better, then they're like, this is awesome. I'll pay more for this, or I will buy this. And I wouldn't do that before. So that's what we're really looking for. And the truth is, there are real examples out there of generative AI-powered solutions that are doing things that we just couldn't do before. So I love it.
You mentioned one of those being product owners. I think there's, what was the one that was like writing code now? There's
Copilot is probably one of the most
Copilot
examples
is one,
from Microsoft. Yeah. No, it's millions are using
that's
that, millions
one.
Of developers. Yeah. And that's a great example of a true value-add product.
It's interesting, like in terms of engineering and where this is heading, right? I mean, you have a product team that is usually like this tripod of leadership that accounts for the four risks. And then you'd have a team of engineers, right? You'd have this, at some point it was front and back end. Now it's like more full stack. You'd have a bunch of full stack engineers, but do you see that changing over time with the advancements of generative AI?
I do, but not really so much in the roles of the team as much as the shape of the team. That's what that article I was mentioning, it's called Preparing for the Future, because I do think some low-level engineers will absolutely be replaced with automation, just as happening with design as well, low-level design, visual design. A lot of that will be done by tools. And just like I think on the administrative parts of product management, like product ownership, will be better supported by tools. All that's true, I think. But the shape of the team, for example, the triad, I don't see any argument for it going away. I just see an argument for those being very strong people. Like the tech lead now has more responsibility, not less. The designer has bigger burden because things like explainability, that's harder with generative AI-powered solutions than it is with conventional solutions. So the designer has an even bigger job. And we already talked about value and especially viability. It's harder with generative AI. For example, if a solution is probabilistic rather than deterministic, that really introduces hard questions around viability. Certain kinds of solutions, beautiful. Other kinds, people could die. You can't mess around with that.
Let's shift a little bit. I wanted to talk about psychological safety in product teams. I wanted to talk about the importance of it and then the approach to build that within teams that are inherently competitive or under high stress. Like you see a lot of these folks that are trying to get things out the door fast, right? Sometimes we need to. But where does that psychological safety within the team lie for you, and how do you measure that?
Well, I would call them orthogonal points. They're both important points. For example, how does a team deal with the stress of looming deadlines? That's sort of one. Mm-hmm. But psychological safety is different. And psychological safety mostly plays out in discovery. And the stress of deadlines mostly plays out in delivery, by the way. But when we talk about psychological safety, it's really the kind of collaboration we need to discover an effective solution. There's a great segment in that, The Lost Interview with Steve Jobs, you might have seen, but there's a great segment where he talks about this explicitly. He talks about the collaboration in discovery of a good team and how he tells the story of how he learned from a neighbor that you could take these rocks from your backyard and you put them in a coffee can with some grit and some water and you run this machine overnight and it just creates friction. And these stones are bumping into each other with the sand. And in the morning, you open up the can and there's these beautiful polished stones. And he says he likes to use that example. That's what happens when you have a good product team is that friction is not only desirable, but it's necessary. But for that to happen, you need psychological safety. If people don't feel safe sharing their contradictory opinion, then you're not going to have any of that friction. And the worst thing to us is if a designer says, I don't care. Every time I say anything, they jump all over me. And then the designer just checks out. Or an engineer says, all right, if you don't, I don't want to play this game with you. If you don't like my ideas, just tell me what to build. This is the beginning of the end. You have lost the battle if that's what happens. And that's a sign that you don't have that psychological safety. So we need to build that trust. And some people would love to work this way. They just have never been given permission that this is okay. And we have to coach our people to say, not only is it okay, this is your job. If you're a product manager, designer, and engineer, your job is to help create that beautiful friction.
One of the things we talked about when you first came on the show was first time head of product management, and these leaders you put in place, you have to really evaluate your people. And this is a part of kind of identifying that psychological safety on the team, but then making like really swift movements around making sure the right people are in the right seats. How do you coach other folks or leaders to take action? And what are the things that you have them look at?
The tools we recommend, and by the way, these tools are all included, not in the book Transform, they're included in the book Empowered, because those are really written for these leaders we're talking about. And those leaders, their primary responsibility is to coach and develop their people. So we share the tools we use. Just like in Transform, we share an assessment of an organization, the one we use, to see where they're at. In Empowered, we share the assessment of a product manager. So we encourage the first thing you do as a leader is you assess each of your people, and then you get to work on a coaching plan. Just like a transformation plan, how are you going to get them from here to there? Coaching plan is how you're going to get this person from where they are now to where you need them to be. And we share that normally that takes about 3 months of real work between the leader, the coach, and the person who's learning these new skills. To me, first of all, I would acknowledge 3 months is not trivial, right? That's more than you can do in a few days, right? That's 3 months. On the other hand, you're talking about somebody becoming competent at a very critical job. I don't think that's that bad at all. And I don't understand why more product leaders don't say, I'm doing that and spend the time to do it. Because that is...
Where do you see the objections coming from?
All I can tell you is that most leaders don't do this. And this is not... I've never really heard anybody dispute this either. Most leaders don't do this. And there's kind of two reasons this could be the case, and it gets to the individual. One reason is they don't know how. Literally, they've never worked in a good organization, so they don't know what good looks like. The other one is they do know how, but they have no time, because they are so busy managing stakeholders, they're so busy on the strategy stuff that it's just not a priority for them. In both of those cases, when that's going on, I recommend that they get a product leadership coach to help them come up to speed so that they can do this.
I've got one more question for you, then we'll jump into our listener questions and what have you. But reflecting on your own career, was there a pivotal moment or decision that could have led you down like a completely different path? And then just wondering how might that have differed?
Well, coincidentally, it's really what we were just talking about happened to me. And I think that was the tipping point for me. I was an engineer. Actually, I had gone from an engineer to a tech lead to an engineering manager. And I really wanted to learn product, because I realized you could have the greatest engineering team in the world, but if the product isn't doing well, you're probably not going to get much out of that great team. So I wanted to learn product. And I remember I went to my manager, who was the engineering VP, and he said, I think it's great you want to learn product. I can't teach you because I've never done it, but I will find someone who can. And I was lucky. I was at a culture, HP Labs at the time, for 10 years. And I always had at least one person to help coach me to get better at my job. And he found this person in another state. I was in Palo Alto and he was in Colorado, but he coached me remotely to learn product. And I remember the first thing he asked me was, I willing, because he wasn't getting anything for this extra. It's just he was doing it as a good citizen leader in the company, but he had a great track record. He had spawned 4 different product divisions, and each division was a roughly $100 million in revenue. So a real innovator. And anyway, he agreed to coach, but the first thing he asked me was, I'm not going to waste my time unless you're willing to put in the work. And I was like, I will do whatever you tell me. I want to learn this. I think it's very important to learn this. And I'm not willing to work on another product that doesn't, where I don't know this. And anyway, he said, okay. And he started by doing an assessment. And I will say, I did not score well on that assessment. I was an engineer. How would I had none of the sales skills, none of the marketing skills, none of the go-to-market understanding, none of the financial analytics understanding. I didn't even really know our customers, even though I thought I did. I didn't know any of this stuff. So he quickly understood where I was, which is why he asked me if I was really willing, serious about putting the effort in. But in truth, within 3 months, he said, okay, I can. He doesn't need to oversee my decisions. And he considered it competent. Not amazing, but competent. And then from there, I was hooked. I realized this is a really high leverage thing. And there was so much more I wanted to learn. I wanted to learn product leadership. I wanted to learn more advanced product management skills. And so that changed the course of my career. And if he hadn't coached me, back then there weren't classes like there are now. So I don't even know. There wasn't books either. The only kind of product management back then that existed really was consumer packaged goods. It was what we call brand management today. It was a different kind of thing. So there wasn't much to do. I could have maybe got lucky because somebody who did it well would have agreed to coach me or mentor me. But that was the lucky break for me in terms of opening my eyes to this whole other side of creating products. His name was Mike Bacco. He passed away several years ago.
I have a similar story where I've had a really impactful mentor in my career that had turned me on to all this stuff and opened up the curiosity. I think it's super critical early on when you're getting into it. But do you remember that kind of 3 months period of time where you had to get up to par with some of these skills? What were the tactics that you put in place? Did you read? Did you?
There was one book in particular he made me read on the basics of finance and accounting because I just never took a class in school. The thing that I remember the most was he said I was not allowed to make a single decision for the team until after I had visited 30 customers. He wanted them to be 15 in the US and 15 in Europe. And we were doing products for companies. They were actually products for developers, but developers at a company we were selling to the business. And I'm like, wow, that's how long? And he said, it's only 3 weeks. In a 3-week business trip, you can visit 30 companies. And he was like telling me, it will change your life. And it really did. And I remember thinking, oh my gosh, I know nothing about our customers. Before I went on the first visit, I thought I knew so much about our customers because our customers were developers and I had been a developer for years. So I thought, I am the customer. And he said, look, all I know for sure is that's never true. It's never true. So that was one of those light bulb moments where you realize, oh my gosh, it's totally different out there and you really have to get out there and meet customers.
Do you recall that finance book that you...
I had it on my shelf for like 20 years. It was like, and now I'm sure there's 100 better books, but it was like Fundamentals of Financial Accounting.
I wanted to shift to some listener questions. So let's start with this. This one's from Shelley Mormon. In your experience in transforming an organization to the new product model, is it more difficult to overcome objections from finance on how to fund product teams or objections from the PMO organization on changing how they track and report on the product outcomes?
Good question. So both of those two are hard, first of all. So this person zeroed right in on a hard one. And you can judge for yourself in the objections because there are a chapter each, one on objections from finance and one on objections from the PMO. If I had to answer that though, I would put them in the hard category. Most of the other ones are easier than these, but in the hard category. But I would say objections from finance are generally easier. And that's because of a little different reason. Finance is as frustrated as anybody about the way product is done in most old ways, because they see the spend and they see the return. So I don't know that I've ever gone to a CFO and them say that they're happy with the return on their technology investment. Not only are they not happy, they're disgusted with the level of return. Literally on the order of 70, 80% of their investments do not yield a return. So it's horrible. From their point of view, this is crazy. They don't know who to believe, who to trust, because every promise that's made doesn't happen. So they don't necessarily know the alternative. They don't even know if there's an alternative. But more than a few CFOs have said, is this really possible that this is the best we can do? Because this is horrible. And then I try to tell them, no, it's not at all the best you can do. And I would love for you to do some experiments to convince yourself of that. But the reason finance, I think, is a little easier is because they want it to change. PMO is tricky because PMO is there. They exist as the enforcement mechanism for the command and control model. So when you transform, you really need, no group is hit culturally harder than the PMO. It is a very, now, do we still have project management? Yes. But there are different ways of doing project management. On one extreme, you have a PMO, which is very much about, look, we're here for governance. We're here for process. We're here for reporting. That is like, I need to know the status of everything, and we're in control of everything that gets done, which is what they do in order to deliver in a sort of top-down, predictability-focused process, like waterfall or like SAFe, which is waterfall, not agile. So that's where the PMO plays. And on the other hand, the kind of project management we need is very different. It's more about, look, we need help managing these dependencies. We need help resolving impediments. We need help tracking the status of some key high integrity commitments we have. But it's not an enforcer. It's not about process and governance. So it's a very different style. And because of this difference, I will say you can't always retrain PMO people to work in the product model.
It sounds like there's folks that are open to it as well. And I guess it just depends on that appetite, right, of change.
And, yeah, you really have to talk to them individually. And yeah. I like to just be very upfront and just say, look, this is a very different game in the product model. And you have to decide if you want to play that new game. Because if you try to play the old game with the product model, either you're going to be completely fired because you're just getting in the way, or you're going to ruin the whole transformation.
This kind of leads into the next question from Mike Baldessari, but he's mentioning the good aspects of project management, which you mentioned a little bit there. I think in the book, you said like in the delivery process, that's really valuable for the dependencies and what have you. And then he's saying with companies in the book that you're describing, do they delineate them as two separate disciplines, or do they just instill the practices within the product people?
I think what he's asking is, should the product manager also be that project manager? And the problem with that is that it's very difficult to do those two jobs. Those are two full-time jobs. And what usually happens is that the one is, if you've ever heard the important versus urgent difference, project management is by definition urgent. Product discovery, which is the job of product management, is by definition important. The important loses to the urgent in almost every case. So this is where the leaders need to step up. In the vast majority of cases, we need those to be different people, just because we need to make sure the product manager is doing her job. And then we have delivery managers / project managers to do the project management. One of the reasons this has been a hot topic lately, is because when companies are transforming, they're usually transforming from feature teams to empowered product teams. And the difference, there are several differences, but the most visible difference is the role of the job of the product manager. On a feature team, the job of a feature team product manager is project management. So, you can absolutely imagine why you'd have a lot of project management going on. But in a product management role, real product management in a real product team, or at least what we're calling a real product team in the product model, no, that's a completely different job. So this is more something that you have to get out on the table. And as a coach or as a manager, you need to talk to each of your people and say, yes, today you've been doing some of each, but you need to decide, are you going to be a product manager or are you going to be a project manager? And there's generally room for both. So it's not that.
This next one is from Jenny Wanger. She's struggling with the negativeness towards support roles, saying that great product teams don't have product ops or agile coaches. She's wondering how product leaders are expected to change a company, the company's leadership's mind on and educate them, set up all the systems for change, educate the team on change, and manage the still all the day-to-day product work without help. How would you respond to that?
Yeah, this person's not alone for having that takeaway. Although I'd like to believe these are people that didn't actually listen to me. These are people that are just spending time on social media because I really don't say this. Now, there's a number of things going on in that question. The most common one is product ops. Here's the problem with product ops. I don't know what kind of product ops this person's talking about. The truth is, I might say, and I do say in the book, and literally in the new book, Transformed, I can tell the people that have actually read the book because it actually makes a plug for product ops. It actually encourages product ops, but only a certain kind of product ops. Right now, there are many different definitions out there. To me, the product ops community needs to get its act together because it is a complete cluster by any objective measure. But there are some good definitions of product ops. And those are the ones I'm a big fan of. The most common is these are the people that help product teams make decisions qualitatively. This is user research and quantitatively. Data analysts. We love that. Those people, those supporting roles have existed for 20 plus years, but putting them as a sort of promoting them to a top level seat at the table called product ops. I love that. On the other hand, a lot of companies, they use the term product ops as an assistant to the product manager that doesn't want to do all the dirty jobs. Now, that's not the only bad definition of product ops, but in fact, we've written that we have found 6 different definitions of product ops out there in use by different companies. So we could talk about all 6, but reading between the lines of this person's question, what we don't like are these assistant roles. Now, there's some real reasons for that. Now, of course, the initial response from most people is, how could they possibly do all this work? The answer is easy. Stop doing the project management. We just talked about that. Stop doing the project management, do the product management. But what a lot of companies do is they say, oh, we need assistants. It might be they have a product manager and a product owner. It might be that they have a product manager and a product ops person that are just literally there. Or sometimes companies do a product manager and an associate product manager. Everybody gets an associate. The problems this causes are written about in the article Two in a Box. So you can see what happens when you split the role in two like that. And yeah, I do not see that as a good pattern. I see that as an anti-pattern. So it depends on the definition of what product ops means. If it's the good one, I'm like, yes, we should have it. And you'll find that plug for that in the recommendation for that in the book Transformed. The reason it's not talked about as one of the 4 new competencies is because it's not a new competency. It's an old competency. It's a really useful one, but it's been around. User research and data analytics have been around. The interpretation of product ops as an assistant or as a governance. That's another one of those anti-pattern ones where they're there for process and governance. Those are the ones, honestly, we're scared to death of. And the other thing I'd say, because the questioner alluding to this between the lines, because we were really talking about product managers, but then she brought in product leaders. And what happens in a lot of companies is the product leaders are not doing their job. And of course, the way to fix that is have the product leaders do their jobs. And in fact, I don't know a successful alternative to the product managers doing their job. But one thing that's sometimes done, if you have a product leader that doesn't know product, is they say, oh, we'll just have a product ops team that'll make sure the product managers know what they're doing. No, that's the product leaders abdicating their responsibility. And frankly, they can't do their job if they don't know their stuff.
Obviously, the book is out. You mentioned you guys were working on a podcast as well. Is there anything else that you want to talk about or share about what's coming up?
I'm just more of the same, really. We are trying to help companies through share those changes. And it is hard. I'd say the one last thing I'd say is that I think when I first started doing this work, it was more about look at the upside of changing. You could work like the best. Today, I feel like that's still true. But now the bigger threat is if you don't start working the way I would argue the best companies work, I think you're at more risk than you want to be. Everybody, of course, everybody has some level of risk. Even in the best companies, they overhire and they correct and all that stuff. But I think you want to be as protected as possible. And I feel like today there's a real urgency for teams to make themselves more valuable. Product managers make themselves more valuable.
And you have all the tools out there. The books are there. The resources are there. Just actually read them, right? Get into it. And I think that'll be the homework for this week. But Marty, you've been so gracious with your time. Thank you so much. And yeah, thanks again for coming on the show, man.
All right. Thanks for inviting me back, Kevin.
Looks like we finished up our coffee, so go level up.
This has been Product Coffee, produced and engineered by me, Kevin Gentry. You can now record a voice message and send us ideas or topics to cover, and who knows, we might end up playing it on the show. You can also become a supporter of Product Coffee by contributing a monthly donation to help us sustain future episodes. Please rate, review, and subscribe to Product Coffee on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.